She only has 60 meters to walk. She's covered the distance 100 times before, but as her garden gate squeaks closed behind her, she has no idea that this morning will be different. Today, her end has already been decided, and somewhere in those 60 meters, she will vanish, as though into thin air. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 191, The Murder of Dilly Skults. This episode is sponsored by the brand new release movie, Tin Soldier. When retired soldier Nash Kavanagh, played by Scott Eastwood, is pulled into a government operation to help bring down a cult-like group, his motivations in agreeing are not entirely selfless. What started as a group to help ex-soldiers recover from PTSD has morphed into a dangerous movement in which the leader, Bokushi, played by Jamie Foxx, is building his own army of mind-controlled mercenaries. Nash knows all too well what a risk the group poses, because he was once one of them. And his wife Everly, played by Nora Arnazida, remains under Bokushi's control. Also starring Academy Award winner Robert De Niro as a CIA operative, Tin Soldier tracks Nash's last-ditch effort to save his wife and stop the Bokushi, all while navigating government secrets that threaten to destabilize everything. Tin Soldier opens in cinemas in South Africa Friday the 8th of August 2025. So press pause and go book your tickets now. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming. And for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You? Yes, you. Are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at True Crime South Africa /donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Sean Ackerley, Graham123, Deanne Flannery, Melanie Wilson, Jose Gomez, and Janelle Hawkins for your support on Patreon, as well as Barry McCall for your support on PayPal. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout-out on the pod, and other exclusive contents, including Q&As with me as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Keba. Today we're taking a trip back in time to explore a vintage true crime case from the 1960s. I occasionally find value in going back to cases like this because it becomes clear that, where crime is concerned at least, as much as things change over time, some things always stay the same. This case has a missing person element to it for a while, and it was really interesting to see how that's played out. In some ways, the same as it might today, but in other ways, very differently. My main research source for this episode was a book called Murder Will Speak by Benjamin Bennett. Bennett was a pioneering true crime writer in South Africa, and I was very lucky to have several of his books donated to the show. I will admit that reading these books, some are written as far back as the 1940s, is quite jarring at times when you see the type of language that's used and how attitudes towards things societally have changed. I'm going to throw a few of the cracker quotes at you from the book throughout the episode, just because I had a good giggle at the ludicrousness of some of them. This is no disrespect to Bennett at all. I understand it was a different time, but I think you'll appreciate how odd they sound today as much as I did. And who knows, maybe in 40 or 50 years, someone will come across one of my books and be amused at the language I used and what I said. Such is the nature of a continually changing world, I guess. So let's get into episode 191, The Murder of Dilly Skultz.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Jane Loveday Hyde Smith was born on the 18th of February 1935. The Hyde Smith family, which would eventually number four children, of which Jane was the only girl, originally lived in England, and the children were born there, and they moved to South Africa when they were still relatively young. Jane had almost never been called by her actual name. Everyone who loved her used the nickname she'd earned as a young girl, Dilly, and the nickname would stick throughout her life. Dilly was known as a happy and outgoing young woman. She enjoyed taking part in theatre productions and was also dedicated to her education, and went much further in her schooling and post-school education than women certainly were expected to in general at that time. Dilly and her family lived in Claremont in the Western Cape, and shortly after she left school, she met and began to date another Claremont resident who would eventually become her husband. Jacobus Eduard Hauman Skultz was 2 years older than Dilly. He was affectionately referred to as Koos by his friends and family. Koos had been born in Elgin in the Western Cape, and after school had studied further and then began working for a British petroleum company's Cape Town branch as a sales representative. Dilly and Koos were very similar in personality, and everyone described them as a perfect couple. So absolutely no one was surprised when in 1956 the pair married, when they were 21 and 23 respectively. Koos continued with his career as a sales rep, and Dilly continued with her job, which she'd begun before she got married. Dilly had started working as a typist at a law firm in the Cape Town CBD, and her meticulous nature and wide range of skills soon made her a very important and trusted member of staff. It's around her work that I found one of the first amusing descriptions in Benjamin Bennett's book, where he says that she likely took this job, quote, probably to avoid the monotony of household chores, which in any case could not keep her fully occupied, end quote. Well, okay then. Koos, too, was doing very well in his work and was in line for a promotion. With two incomes coming into the household and no children, the couple were enjoying their lives together. They were very social and had many friends and often went out to dinner, took trips to the beach, went out to nightclubs, and just generally enjoyed a full and vibrant life together. On the matter of children, Koos and Dilly had wanted to conceive. But after their marriage and trying for some time with no success, doctors had told them that they may need to accept they may not be able to conceive. Although disappointed, the resilient couple started looking into adoption. After they'd married, they moved into a lovely little cottage in Rondebosch. Houses in many areas still had their own names at that time, and the Skultz's home was called Greenways, in Erin Road, Rondebosch. I always find it fascinating when I do these old cases to try and figure out where these places are today and what they look like. Although I wasn't able to 100% ascertain where Greenway's cottage is in Erin Road today, I did spend probably an inordinate amount of time trying to match up an aerial view of the area from the Argus in the 1960s to an aerial view from Google Maps today. Just in case you think I'm immune to rabbit holes. I certainly am not. One thing I was able to ascertain that is certainly the same in the Cape today as it was back then is the lack of parking in a lot of areas. And this would actually end up playing a huge role in this case. When the couple had moved to Greenways, they'd had to purchase additional parking garages on other surrounding properties. Coors's car garage was the closest to their home, really just next door. And I guess that's probably because he was a sales rep who spent a lot of time in his car and on the road. Dilly's garage was on a different property, but really not that far from their cottage either. She would walk out of her gate just a few steps down Erin Road and then turn into a lane which led to the property of a local sculptor. His home's name was Gray's Cottage, and he had a relatively large yard with a spare garage on it, which he rented out to Dilly. The walking distance between Greenways and Dilly's car garage was just 59 metres. Unfortunately for her, those 59 metres would prove far too much on one day. The Schultz couple, like most, were in a pretty solid routine, which they followed almost every day of the week. And that routine would be no different, up to a point for Dilly at least, on the morning of Monday the 3rd of July 1961. By then Dilly was 26 and Coors was 28. They were deep into the search for a child to adopt, but nothing had come about yet, so they were still living their very happy lives as just the two of them. Of course, in these cases, we often hear how couples look exceedingly happy from the outside, and sometimes that's not really the case behind closed doors. With the Schultzes, though, it did seem to be the same externally and internally. Their housekeeper, Gertrude, who'd been hired when the couple had married and moved into Greenways, and so had been with them for 5 years, would later say that the couple were very close and often laughed and joked together, and she'd never heard an angry word muttered between them. On that Monday morning, Gertrude heard more of that laughter and joking coming from the bathroom as Coors and Dilly got ready for work together. Coors then had a light breakfast, and by 8 a.m. he was planting a kiss on Dilly's cheek, greeting Gertrude, and out the door to his car, as was his routine. His job as a sales rep meant he'd usually go straight from home to see clients, and then go to the office around midday. And that was exactly what he planned to do that morning. Dilly had dressed that morning in a new green Tyrolene skirt she'd just bought, a brown jersey and cardigan, and finished the outfit with a long fawn-coloured coat. She slipped into stiletto heels and checked her handbag to ensure she had everything she needed. She'd put 2 10-rand notes in her purse that morning as she planned to stop at the grocery store on the way home from work. To that end, she'd also taken a grocery bag with her and 3 legal files she'd brought home to work on over the weekend. The files that needed to be urgently worked on and were required back at the office that day for client meetings. With everything set to go, she told Gertrude that she should phone her at work during the day if she remembered anything else they needed from the grocery store. And then at exactly 8:20 a.m., she said goodbye and headed out. Gertrude heard the door close, and then the front gate squeak shut. She then recalled hearing Dilly's high heels clicking against the paving as she walked down Erin Road, and then headed up the lane to her garage. The other parts of Dilly's usual morning routine included greeting a man who worked at the home where her garage was. His name was George Thompson, but everyone called him Buck Jones because he had an affinity for dressing like a cowboy, complete with the hats, corduroy pants, and boots. Then Dilly would usually drive to Claremont to collect her mother, and they'd both head to Cape Town CBD, where they worked at different buildings. Dilly's mom could have caught the train to work like others without vehicles, but her daughter was going that way anyway in her red Fiat 500, and mother and daughter were extremely close, so both valued the additional time together now that Dilly was no longer living at home. Just 5 minutes after Dilly had left her home that day, a schoolgirl walking down Erin Road passed the lane that led to Gray's cottage and heard a woman's scream come from that direction. She paused for a moment, wondering whether she'd really heard what she thought she had, and when she didn't hear anything else, continued walking. 5 minutes after that, a woman who lived in a block of flats on Belmont Road, which crosses Erin, spotted thick, dark smoke coming from behind the garage at Gray's cottage. The woman was used to seeing smoke there. She knew the man who looked after the premises would often dig holes and burn rubbish. But this stood out because the smoke looked different than it usually did. After a few minutes, though, it started to fade, and she would think nothing more of it for some time after that. At 8:40 a.m., the phone in Greenway's cottage rang. Gertrude answered and found it was Dilly's mom on the line. The woman was asking whether her daughter had been running late, as she hadn't yet arrived to collect her. Gertrude told Mrs. Hyde-Smith that Dilly had left the house at her normal time of 8:20 a.m. Mrs. Hyde-Smith waited a few minutes longer at her home in Claremont, and then, thinking that her daughter must have had a flat tire or some other delay, went ahead and took the train to work. When she arrived at work, she immediately phoned Dilly's employer and asked if her daughter was at work. She wasn't. By 9:30 a.m., when Dilly still hadn't arrived at work, Mrs. Hyde-Smith phoned Coors's office. Her son-in-law was still on the road, and she left a message that he should phone her as soon as he arrived at work. Isn't it interesting to think how different cell phones have made our lives? The only options Dilly's mom had to track her daughter down that day were her home and her office. Today, we'd just immediately phone the person's cell phone, and if they'd been delayed, they could just let us know on ours. And with Coors being on the road, he was essentially completely out of reach until he arrived back at his office. I mean, I have lived without a cell phone. Yes, I am that old, but not really as an adult. From when I was about 21 or 22, cell phones were pretty easily accessible. And they also doubled up as weapons because they weighed more than most gym weights. But that's probably not relevant here. I just found it fascinating to see how much we relied on landlines at this time, and also how patient you had to be. There were no instant responses or reassurances from a quick text fired off to a loved one. If you wanted to know if they were okay, you'd just have to wait for the phone in your house or office to ring. And this is where Mrs. Hyde-Smith found herself on that morning. By 10 a.m., Gertrude, having heard again from Mrs. Hyde-Smith that Dilly still had not arrived at work, took it upon herself to walk up to the garage where she knew Dilly's car was stored. The garage door was closed, but through a small gap, she could clearly see that the car was still in there. Gertrude telephoned Mrs. Hyde-Smith and told her what she'd seen. Now, neither knew what to think. Where on earth could Dilly be if her car was still in its garage? At 11:45, Coors arrived at the office after seeing clients. He immediately returned his mother-in-law's call, and upon hearing the news that his wife seemed to be missing, he then phoned her work. Her employer said they were becoming very concerned that Dilly had not arrived for work, Firstly, it was completely unlike her, but also she had very important client files with her, and they were now unsure whether they should reschedule those appointments, as they couldn't proceed without the files. Kuss spent the next few minutes phoning a few of Dilly's friends to find out if they'd heard from her at all. And when those avenues were unsuccessful, he told his boss he needed the rest of the day off and headed home. After having confirmed everything that Gertrude knew, Kuss headed out to Dilly's garage. His hope was that perhaps she'd opened the garage to find her car had a flat tire and had decided to take the train and perhaps got off at the wrong station and was trying to make her way back to work. With 4 hours having passed, though, he was sure his wife would have found a public phone to call either him or her mother. But it was all he could think of at the time. At the Grey's Cottage garage, Kuss found George Thompson in the yard. The man approached him as soon as he entered. They knew each other in passing, and after greeting, George asked Kuss whether anything was wrong, as he looked worried. Kuss said he was looking for his wife, and asked George if he'd seen her that day. George said he hadn't. In fact, he'd thought it was strange, as she was usually there at the same time every day. But when he hadn't seen her that morning, he thought perhaps she'd taken a sick day and wasn't going to work. Kuss told George that she had not taken the day off, and she'd left the house, presumably headed to collect her car that morning, according to the housekeeper, but had never made it to work. Kuss opened the garage door and looked at his wife's car. It was still locked, and nothing seemed out of place. All four tires were in good condition, and there seemed no reason that she wouldn't have been able to drive it out as she had every other morning. Now completely perplexed, Kuss thanked George, closed the garage and went home. After a last round of calls to Dilly's work and her mom, Kuss decided to call the police. The initial reaction from police was relatively similar to what we might see today in the case of a missing adult, especially when they've only been missing for 4 hours. Police did send a constable around to Kuss's house to take a report, but the man seemed rather unconcerned and continuously told Kuss that he was sure his wife would return safely by the end of the day. Benjamin Bennett writes a bit about missing people in general in this chapter, and how the vast majority solve themselves without much effort from police, despite families always reacting with horror and jumping to the worst possible conclusions. One particular reference he makes to what husbands often think when their wives go missing made me cringe and chuckle a little. Quote, "The husbands opine that their wives have probably suffered a nervous breakdown and gone off in a state of hysteria, heaven knows where." End quote. Because, you know, women are just regularly succumbing to fits of hysteria everywhere, probably because their time was not sufficiently filled by their household chores. Anywho, back to the serious stuff. Kuss and Dilly's family were understandably distressed at the police's initial reaction. Although the police had insinuated that perhaps he and Dilly had had an argument that morning and she'd gone off to teach him a lesson, he knew very well that wasn't true. Gertrude also knew for a fact that they hadn't been angry with each other that morning because she'd witnessed them laughing and joking together and hugging and kissing each other goodbye. Dilly's mother absolutely knew that even if her daughter had inexplicably decided to leave her husband, there was no way she would disappear without giving her an explanation. Even Dilly's employer insisted that the woman they knew was so punctual, dedicated and loyal, that there was no way she would have just disappeared, leaving them not just in the lurch in terms of staffing, but also with three very important client files now gone with her. Despite insisting that Dilly was likely fine and just somewhere cooling off, The police did at least check out the garage area. There, two constables came across George Thompson, and they recognized him immediately. Thompson was well known in the area. Most residents knew him because of his cowboy look, but police knew him for a different reason. Thompson was a police informant, and like many informants, he had a significant criminal past himself. Thompson's criminal history included several terms in prison for robbery and theft, and most recently he'd spent a year incarcerated for a brutal assault. The man was also a known alcoholic and a cannabis user, which in the 1960s was of course not nearly as normalized as it is today. Thompson was not really the greatest police informant, and most of his information usually got the police into more trouble than anything else. He had occasionally been helpful over the years, but he seemed to want attention more than anything, and often arrived at the police station wanting to open cases against people for the most random of things. Castle, the sculptor who owned Gray's Cottage, had brought Thompson on as a garden and general worker. He didn't pay the man much, but allowed him to sleep in a room he had open at the back of his lot, which was next to the garage in which Dilly's car was kept. On the day the constables arrived there, Thompson was carting house rubbish around in a wheelbarrow and burning it in the backyard. He seemed happy enough to see the two officers he knew, and when asked about Dilly Skoltz, he said that he usually saw the woman every weekday, but he hadn't seen her on that morning. Police checked the garage and Dilly's car and went on their way with no more information having been forthcoming. Kuss and Dilly's friends and family ignored the police's assurances that she'd come home on her own and soon started their own searches for her. They took her picture and scoured the streets, asking anyone who would stop whether they'd seen her. They searched fields and bush areas and even rode the train line between Rondebosch and the CBD around 9 a.m. the next day, hoping to come across people who may have seen Dilly if she had, for some unknown reason, decided to use the train instead and disappeared during that trip. Dilly's brothers, although spread across the country, quickly came back home to help search, and one brother manned the phones at home in the hopes that a tip would come in. By the 5th of July, Dilly had been missing for 2 full days, and her husband and family were now completely convinced she'd been forcibly abducted somewhere between her home and her car. They decided to go to the press and see if they would print an article about Dilly's disappearance, and this is when Benjamin Bennett had become involved in the story. The Argus did print Dilly's picture with a description of what she'd been wearing on the day she disappeared. Although the coverage did bring in a flurry of leads, many of them were quickly discounted. And it had an unfortunate side effect in that many members of the public started to target Kuss, saying that he had killed Dilly and hidden her body. What they didn't know is that very early on, despite claiming that they were certain Dilly was fine, police had already asked Kuss to confirm his alibi, which he was happy to do. He had driven with police on the exact route he'd taken on the morning of the 3rd. They dropped in at each client's office, and Kuss had stayed in the car while police went inside and confirmed with the individual that they had indeed seen Kuss that day. By the end of it, they were happy that all of his time had indeed been accounted for. He'd left the house at 8 a.m, and by the confirmed time he arrived at his first client, there would have been no time for him to wait for his wife to leave the house at 8:20, kill her, dispose of her body, and still make it to his first client at the time he had. Of course, they didn't tell the public that. So Kuss continued to receive harassing calls and letters accusing him of killing Dilly. Again, this is not something that has really changed. Yes, it is common for women to be murdered by their partners, and they're definitely one of the first people to be investigated. but it can't be an assumption we jump to without any information. In 1961, Coors was targeted with calls, which Dilley's brother started to circumvent by manning the phones himself, and letters were dropped off on his doorstep. Occasionally, when he was out searching for his wife, someone would recognize him and shout obscenities at him. Today, we see this happening instantly and en masse through social media. There's so much of our information out on the internet that it's actually not difficult to find someone's cell phone number or place of work and start harassing them directly. This is another reason I often recommend family members don't put their numbers out when their loved ones go missing. Coors did his best to block out the hateful comments and continued on his mission to find his wife. A few leads that came in from the press coverage seemed like they might send the investigation in a different direction. A family friend called in to say they'd seen Dilley in Cape Town CBD on the day she disappeared around 2 p.m. They said she looked absolutely fine and had greeted them and continued on her way. Another woman called in to say she'd also seen a woman resembling Dilley at a lunch spot in the CBD. She said the woman looked upset, and she'd asked her if she needed help, but she'd left without responding. Then, a taxi driver contacted the police, claiming that he had picked up a woman who looked like Dilley in Rondebosch on the morning she disappeared. She'd told the driver that she was running away from her family. A private investigator even called in with less of a lead and more of an opinion, because he had no evidence to support his statement, but he said that Coors should just face up to the fact that Dilley had run away with the secret lover. Well, okay, great private investigator. All these leads were run down by police, and although they could not be completely discounted, they also weren't able to be independently verified as either definitely having happened or definitely having involved Dilley. And let me tell you, it's actually not unheard of for people to convince themselves they've seen something they haven't, just to be helpful. In addition, we all get days wrong, sometimes, and our sense of time can often be off. So someone like the family friend, for instance, who was sure they'd seen Dilley on the 3rd, may well have actually seen her on a different day instead and got the days mixed up. It's not intentional. And really, even if you're not sure, you should report it, because you never know what's going to be helpful. Unfortunately, none of these leads took the case forward, but the public was heavily invested in this case. In the days that Dilley was missing, her friends and family racked their brains to come up with scenarios that could explain her disappearance. Unfortunately, none of those options were very positive. They knew she had not run away, and if she'd been taken by someone by force, she was either somewhere right at that moment being harmed, or she was dead. Coors figured that the most likely scenario was that Dilley had arrived at the garage and someone in a car had pulled in behind her and abducted her quickly and quietly so that no one had seen anything. By the 7th of July, Dilley had been missing for 4 days, and it seemed police were finally willing to accept that she had not left of her own accord. In fact, in an official statement, they made a complete about turn and now said that they believed Dilley was in fact dead, that she'd been murdered by someone on the morning of the 3rd of July, and in addition, they were going to start digging up the entire area around the garage to try and find her body. With nothing left to do but wait, Coors and Dilley's family gathered at Greenway's cottage. From the lounge, as they mindlessly sipped tea after tea, just to have something to do, they could hear the sounds of spades hitting the ground in the distance. Occasionally, a shout would come up from one of the officers and they would freeze, wondering if this was the moment that their worst fears would be confirmed. but then the murmurs would die down and the digging would start again. And they'd slip back into staring into the distance and occasionally engaging in threads of small talk, which soon petered off and were left hanging loose, never picked up again, as none of it really mattered at all. Finally, on the 9th of June, the digging stopped again, and the police officers' voices raised as they had before, but this time, within half an hour, there was a knock on the door of Greenway's cottage. Coors opened the door to two senior police officers with their hats in their hands and grim expressions on their faces. The body of 26-year-old Dilly Schultz was found that day. She'd been buried in a relatively deep hole, and the ground had been levelled off so well that the burial site had not stood out in peripheral searches. Her body had been wrapped in sacks, and her killer had set fire to her remains. Some of her belongings, including her work files, were found underneath her body. Around her neck was a white tie with red polka dots on it. The tie was wound around her neck several times and then tied in a single adjustable knot. Coors was asked to identify Dilly's body. Police covered all but her face with a blanket and attempted to cover the tie so that the true horror of her death would not be immediately apparent to her husband. He was able to confirm that it was indeed his wife before almost collapsing and being helped back to his home by his brother-in-law. As soon as one police officer on site that day saw the tie around Dilly's neck, he knew who it belonged to. He'd been in a courtroom the previous year when a state witness, an informant, had taken the stand to testify. He'd remembered the distinctive tie the man had been wearing because he'd never seen one quite like it. The dots were so large, it was almost clown-like, he'd thought, but very in keeping with the individual's usual eclectic sense of dress. The man who owned that tie was George Thompson. It did not take very long for police to track George Thompson down. In fact, they would use the same informant network he had once been a part of to locate him. The first man they approached was often seen with Thompson, so they figured he might know something. The man, who went by Johnson, said that in the morning of the 3rd of July he'd been passing the garage area when Thompson had spotted him and called out, telling him to wait for a bit and then he'd take him for a drink. Johnson explained that he'd had to wait more than half an hour for George Thompson, who appeared to be burning rubbish in the field behind the garage. Then they'd gone to a bar, and Thompson had produced 2 10-rand notes and purchased alcohol. After that, they'd gone to a nearby park where they had sat with some friends, and Thompson had supplied alcohol for the whole group, who drank there until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. From other avenues of investigation, police discovered that after leaving the park, Thompson had gone back to the cottage, apparently packed up some things, and left. His boss said he hadn't seen him since that day. Thompson had then gone to Windermere, where he'd approached a woman he knew and asked her to sell a watch for him. The woman led police to the individual who'd purchased the watch, and it was identified as belonging to Dilly Schultz. From there, Thompson had gone to visit his mother, who lived on the farm Nooitgedacht in Stellenbosch. He'd brought his mother groceries and given her money. Although Thompson was no longer at his mother's house when police arrived to arrest him, he'd not gotten far, and they spotted him walking on the side of the road as they drove out. Just as they stopped and snapped handcuffs around his wrists, another car pulled up behind them. It was one of the farm supervisors, who'd known Thompson and his family for many years. He asked Thompson what was happening and if he needed help. Thompson wailed that he'd made a big mistake and killed a woman This was before police had even had a chance to explain why they were there and what he was charged with. The supervisor asked why he'd done such a thing. And Thompson said he didn't know. There was just something inside him that had made him do it. He went on to explain that he had used his tie to strangle the woman to death. Police advised Thompson of his rights and took him back to Rondebosch, where he asked to be taken to a magistrate so that he could provide his statement. He was once again warned that if he provided a statement, it could be used against him in court. But he insisted he wanted to confess, and he would later do just that. In his confession, Thompson claimed that when Dilly arrived to collect her car that morning, something had just overcome him, and he'd walked into the garage behind her and grabbed her from behind around the throat. He explained that she'd quickly fallen to the garage floor, and he tied his tie around her neck and strangled her until he was sure she was dead. He then robbed her of the money in her purse and her watch and burned her body for a while in a hole in the yard before covering the grave up. When Koos and Dilly's family were advised that her killer had been arrested, they were shocked to discover the man's identity. No one had suspected that the likable man they called Buck Jones had been capable of such violence. When they discovered his extensive criminal history, they were equally shocked. Most had thought that he was simply an alcoholic who had struggled through his life due to his addiction. When Thompson's trial began in October 1961, it seemed that with legal counsel, he was now slightly changing his story. He still admitted to having killed Dilly, but he now claimed that he'd done so under duress and under the guidance of another, his friend and occasional drinking buddy, Johnson. It was only after Thompson and his defense attorney had gone over the evidence the police had gathered against him, which of course included Johnson's statement, that Thompson had started to include Johnson in the events of that day. He now claimed that he'd been sleeping when Johnson had knocked on his door early in the morning and asked him about the woman who parked her car in the garage. Thompson claimed he was sleepy and at first didn't quite understand what Johnson was trying to say. But after Johnson had pulled out some alcohol for them to drink and cannabis to smoke, he'd started to realize that the man was suggesting they should rob Dilly and kill her. Thompson said that he hadn't wanted to do it, and he'd sent Johnson away. But the man had returned a little later, just before Dilly arrived to collect her car. Johnson kept on insisting, Thompson said, and eventually he'd just gone along with it and done what his friend had suggested. He had killed Dilly, he said, but not because he wanted to, and it wasn't his idea. This distinction between it having been a spur-of-the-moment thing that someone else had suggested to him while he was in an intoxicated state, and the opposite of that, which would be a deliberate and even premeditated action, was actually a pretty important thing for Thompson to be able to prove. In fact, it was literally a life-or-death distinction for him. Because if it could be proven that he had deliberately killed Dilly with premeditation, he could be sent to the gallows. So really, the prosecution were not entirely shocked at the turn of events. And soon enough, they'd have what they needed to counter it. When Johnson had been spoken to about his experience with George Thompson on the morning Dilly was murdered, police, of course, could not just take his word for it. He was essentially putting himself at the scene of the crime at the time it happened, and so he had to be cleared as a possible suspect himself. Thompson had claimed that his friend had arrived at the house early that morning and provided alcohol and cannabis before introducing this idea that they should rob and kill Dilly. But Johnson claimed that he'd first walked past the garage at about 8:40 a.m. If this was the case, then he couldn't have been involved in the murder. Johnson's claims of timing were actually also confirmed by another witness. Remember the lady who lived in the block of flats overlooking Erin Road, who saw weird smoke coming from the area behind the garage at around 8:30? So that was one thing that confirmed Johnson's version of having arrived after the murder was committed. And the other was quite a lucky happenstance for him, because he'd been stopped by a local resident in the street quite far up from Erin Road. The resident had wanted Johnson to do some garden work for him, and they chatted for at least 10 minutes, discussing when he could do the work and how much he would get paid. That conversation had started around the same time Dilly would have been leaving the house. The resident knew this because they'd regularly checked their watch as they were headed to the store and had to be back home for something at a specific time. We know that Dilly was murdered between 8:20 and 8:30, and by 8:35, her body was already being burned. So that alibi meant that Johnson could not have been with Thompson at that time. But what about Thompson's claim that Johnson had been at his room much earlier in the morning to discuss his plan for the first time? Well, the commune Johnson stayed at was a pretty good alibi for that period, because there were several people living there, and many of them had seen Johnson in the residence at around 5:30 when Thompson claimed he was at his home, convincing him to murder Dilly. So that took Johnson out of the picture, and it removed any possible mitigation around Thompson possibly being coerced into killing Dilly. And a new piece of information would come to light during the trial that also proved he was lying about the murder having been a spur-of-the-moment decision. The man who owned Gray's cottage often had visitors staying the night, and one man who'd been sleeping over there on the weekend going into Monday the 3rd of July had come forward with information he hadn't thought was pertinent at the time until he'd learned that his friend's general worker had been arrested for murder. The man explained that around 4:30 a.m. on the morning of the 3rd of July, he was awoken by a strange sound coming from the garden of Gray's cottage. The sound had gone on for a while, and unable to get back to sleep, he went out onto the patio of the cottage to see if he could figure out what it was. He soon realized it was coming from behind the garage area, and it was the sound of digging. The man knew that George Thompson often dug holes to burn rubbish in, so he immediately thought that this was what he was doing, although he did find it strange and a little annoying that he was doing it in the dark so early in the morning. As a guest, he felt it wasn't really his place to say anything, so he'd gone back to bed and tried to fall asleep. The digging had continued for some time after, he said. Now, let's go back to some of the points we've already covered. Police said that Dilly was burned in the hole in the ground. Thompson's own initial statement also said he had done so. And the burning was already happening just 5 minutes after she was believed to have been killed. The grave in which Dilly was found was not shallow, nor was it narrow. She was lying flat and was buried deeply enough that the ground had been flattened well enough to avoid anyone noticing that there was anything buried there. This was quite different to the other holes dotted around the property that Thompson used to burn rubbish in. These were just relatively small and shallow holes that formed mounds when covered up. There's absolutely no way that George Thompson could have dug a grave big enough and deep enough to bury Dilly in the span of 5 minutes between when he killed her and when the burning had been witnessed. So that large grave-like hole had to have been pre-dug. Probably around the time the guest had heard digging at 4:30 a.m. under the cover of darkness. And all of those pieces of information fit into a puzzle which spells out one thing: premeditation. At least from the moment George Thompson woke up that morning, and perhaps for even longer than that, he had already known he was going to kill Dilly Schultz. Despite this information being presented, Thompson's defense attorney still tried his level best to introduce reasonable doubt that Dilly had died by strangulation. He actually got two forensic pathologists to testify on the stand that it was not beyond the realm of possibility that Dilly had actually died of a massive heart attack brought on when Thompson had placed his forearm around her neck. The defense referred to other instances where individuals had died after pressure had been placed on their carotid artery. Essentially, what the defense was saying was that George had only been trying to stop Dilly from screaming, and she'd accidentally died from his actions to silence her. In cross-examination, though, the prosecution asked the doctors whether there was any way to categorically say that Dilly would not have recovered after having her throat constricted. The doctors had, of course, said no, there was no way to prove that either way. But of course, the prosecution said, any hope of her recovering that may have existed would have been completely lost when Thompson wound the tie around her neck and proceeded to strangle her. In addition, it was shown that this had been done with incredible force, because Dilly's hyoid bone was broken. The defense also raised another point with the two doctors, which they clearly hoped to use as mitigation, and that was Thompson's alcoholism. The defense asked the doctors whether a chronic alcoholic would feel such a deep need to acquire more alcohol that they might do anything to get the money to do so, including murder. Although both doctors agreed that any person with a substance addiction of any kind is often drawn into a vicious circle of feeding their addiction, which can lead to committing crime or doing things they ordinarily wouldn't for their next fix. One doctor said something that I found quite bizarre. He said that he would expect what he called an alcoholic from a lower class, i.e. a poor person, to be more likely to commit violent crime to get what they wanted because they were, quote, not educated enough to not make such a poor decision, end quote. I mean, wouldn't it just make more sense that people of a so-called higher class, according to him, just had more money and resources and therefore did not have to resort to any criminal behavior to get alcohol? Does one really need education to know that killing someone is wrong for any reason? Either way, although the judge would ultimately acknowledge that Thompson's alcoholism probably did play a role in his poor decision-making, he didn't find that it was significant enough to be mitigating. In fact, the proof of premeditation in that he'd spent time digging a grave for Dilly in the dark of an early morning cast all of that aside. If all he wanted was money, he could easily just have mugged Dilly and run off, or mugged someone else, or asked his boss for a loan, or asked Dilly if she could spare him any cash. There were a multitude of options open to him, and none of them had to end in murder. The judge ultimately found George Thompson guilty of the murder of Dilly Schultz, and due to the cruelty of the act and his clear planning of it, the man was sentenced to death. On the 29th of March 1962, George Thompson was walked up the stairs to the gallows. A cloth was placed over his face and a noose was placed around his neck. Within minutes, he was dead. In a sad irony, he died of a similar mechanism to his victim. Only he knew it was coming. And he was given the gift of being able to say goodbye to those he loved, unlike Dilly, who was ripped away from her beautiful life in seconds for 20 rand. Over the last 6 years, I've had the privilege of interacting with families who have lost loved ones in ways just like this. In senseless, cruel crimes that could so easily have been avoided and left those who stayed behind with a lifetime of what-ifs. I've borne witness to the type of impact a loss like this has on people. How it presents in their lives and their futures differs from person to person. But without fail, no one is ever the same person they were after suffering a violent criminal death in their family or anyone close to them. There is always a sense of before and after. And you do not move past something like this. Rather, you move forward with it. I don't know what life looked like for those who loved Dilly Skultz after her murder. Sometimes people who knew the victims and their families reach out after I release episodes, so maybe that will happen here too. Maybe, somewhere, Dilly has become the family story that's told in hushed tones and remembered with reverence for the future she lost and the role she may have played in the lives of those who were left behind and who came after her in her family lineage. I was able to determine that Dilly's husband, Koos, lived until the age of 87. He passed away in 2019, and his most recent address was still in the Western Cape, although perhaps understandably no longer in Rondebosch. There was no living spouse listed for him, nor any children. So I don't know whether he married again after Dilly was killed, and maybe his second wife had died before him. Or perhaps he never remarried at all. I hope the latter is not the case. I hope the long life he lived was filled with the kind of love he had with Dilly. Something I've seen in other families where members have been lost to violent crime is when their siblings start to have children. Every now and then there's a child born that looks exactly like the lost loved one. It's quite haunting, actually. And I often wonder what those children feel when they're told they look exactly like their lost aunt or uncle, or they're shown a picture and see themselves reflected back. Even more strangely, occasionally I've had these family members tell me that these descendants even have very similar personalities and mannerisms to the deceased person. Now, that could entirely be projection, or a matter of genetics in terms of skills, or even just related to an individual growing up in a similar environment to the lost loved one. Whatever it is, it's often a huge comfort to the family to see a face they thought they'd never see again. I hope Dilly's family had that. A little Dilly lookalike who got the chance to grow into her own woman, who reached her 27th birthday and beyond, and who didn't meet a George Thompson. Jane Loveday Skultz. Dilly. Rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.